for many of us, a return to our vacation Bible school days and the songs of our youth. We have one announcement for today, and that is that Presbyterian women are hosting a luncheon in this room tomorrow from 11 to 1. Everyone is invited. And Susan Holman, are you here? I don't see Susan. So I have two tidbits to share with you. One of them I know is public. The other one I'm not positive is, but I'm going to tell you anyway. The first, so if it's supposed to be a surprise, you can act like it's a surprise tomorrow. The first is that the speaker is a fellow by the name of Brent Gudgel, who is a documentary filmmaker, and his film company is called Daydox Films. It's Deidox. It is an amazing ministry telling of God's faithfulness and love around the world through the medium of film. Brent and his company have offices here on this campus, and they do documentaries here locally as well as internationally. So he will be talking about their work and showing some documentary snippets as well. Well worth your time. The second thing is that there will be an honorary life membership awarded, and that's I think it's public. That will be given to Ann Brown. No, it's not public. Never mind. So nobody knows who that's going to be. Pardon me? Oh, so it's already been given, so it is public. Ann Brown. Thank you. Bretna knows all, so thank you for filling me in. So that the correct information is Ann Brown has received hers, and there will be another person to receive one on Thursday tomorrow. So you would want to be present for that. We are fortunate today to have Carla Gillen, who has agreed to tell her story. So, Carla, thank you.
Thank you, Laura. I have a lot to cover in a little bit of time, so I'm going to talk really fast and just kind of jump in. For those of you that weren't here last year, I started an art business called Kittredge Lane and Company. As a passion with a purpose and a calling. And for those that you were here last year, I am going to give you an update. I am proud to report that after a year of starting this new business, I am in 3 gift shops and I participated in 4 art shows, one of those being the West Austin Studio Tour, where the business gives back to women undergoing breast cancer treatment. So I was able to donate some proceeds to the Breast Cancer Resource Center here in Austin that provides education and community and counseling in our area. I did not do this alone. I had God winks along the way, one of them being Sarah Crawford, my previous lamplighter leader, and she knew I was going to be making sales calls to the Texas Gulf Coast region. And she said, you know what, I was just at Lorraine Volk's house, and she's from Corpus. Why don't I introduce you to? And so she did, and I'm proud to say that through her connections, I am in a store there beginning in the fall. Another God wink I had, I was making sales calls in Florida at a gift shop along 30A, and I came across this St. Brendan pendant. And St. Brendan is the patron saint of the U.S. Navy and those that like to kayak, which is me. But even more importantly, he's the patron saint of those navigating new waters, which was very meaningful to me. I came home, I looked up his prayer, and I highly suggest you do as well. I have adopted it, and here are just 2 sentences that I have clung to this year. He says, to be able to journey beyond the familiar, and may my obedience count. Now, I have to tell you, I had expectations. I had, for this art business, it was going to be a full-time vocation, and it was going to, you know, help my family's budget balance at the end of the month, and it was going to be so abundant and provide for all these people and pay for their medical bills, and, you know, I was going to sell product and be in galleries. And I have to tell you, it has not been that way at all. And my sweet prayer partners through this journey, my Lamplighter small group and my summer Bible study, have held me up as I've been down and discouraged, wondering, why did I get called to do this when I'm not making any money? It's been a whole year. The expenditures far outweigh the income. why am I doing this? And I really started to question who I was following. And I know in our first week we talked about Matthew 5, verse 1, where Jesus goes up the mountainside and the disciples follow. And I really started to question, who am I following? And my sweet summer Bible study girls, they're the ones that put up with me discussing, okay, whining. What if I'm following the God that, you know, wants us to subsist on honey and locusts? I'm not a honey and locust kind of girl. I'm a department store makeup kind of girl. So they put up with a lot. But I'm here to tell you I did find out who I was following. It has been a long uphill battle, and it has not been successful in the ways of my expectation. But I'm here to say that he has shown me who I'm following. And for my birthday recently, I had lunch with my bestest friend, and she handed me a gift, and she's so apologetic. She's like, I don't know why I bought this for you, but I reached in, and it was a department store makeup. And I was like, you don't know how you just answered prayer. And you don't know what a gift that is, that God sees me, knows me, and fulfills the Psalms, that he gives us our heart's desires. So, at my last, well, hopefully not last, at my most recent art show, it was a complete failure. I sold zero things. I drove 758 miles to Florida and had a solo art exhibit. I partnered with this wonderful charity for her, as in golf for. Amy Walsh is the founder of that and does golf tournaments to raise money for women undergoing treatment and gets their cars repaired so they can get their doctor's appointments. It's a beautiful charity. But since I sold nothing, I had nothing to give her. And I have to say, I was down. And I'm packing up at the end of the night at this gallery. And she comes over and she's like, I just want to share with you that I've been watching what you've been doing. And, you know, I've been meaning to do this for some time, but I'm reorganizing my entire charity to not be an event-based charity anymore, but to provide education, community, and counseling for the women of Northwest Florida. And I knew that God had made my obedience count, and he answers prayers, and he's trustworthy, and I can follow him. Thank you.
Thank you, Carla. That was beautiful and meaningful. And I am given to understand that public speaking is not your true love, so that you indeed followed Jesus to stand up and talk to us today and give us that gift. So thank you very much for your obedience in following him in this business venture and in following him in speaking to us, because that has enlarged all of our hearts. And I would encourage anyone else who has a story and feels a nudge to be obedient as well and take this opportunity. Speak with Lorraine Volk. Lorraine, would you raise your hand? Lorraine is over here, and Lorraine can make that happen. So thank you, Carla, and thank you, Lorraine, for helping us make this a reality. So last week was the Beatitudes. This week we are entering into the remainder of the Sermon on the Mount. The Sermon on the Mount marks the official beginning of Jesus' earthly ministry. And last week Jan pointed out that Matthew intentionally establishes Jesus' royal credentials. So if anything, the Sermon on the Mount is kind of Jesus' coronation speech, if there is such a thing. The Beatitudes are often compared to the preamble to the U.S. Constitution, interestingly enough. And part of the reason for that is that something new is entering the world. The Beatitudes are a very beautiful but very unexpected description of the kingdom of heaven. The preamble to the U.S. Constitution is a beautiful and unexpected picture of people creating a country based on common values rather than on common history or on a shared place of birth. So none of us were there when this country was founded. A lot of generations have come and gone since then, and most of us probably don't even have direct ancestors who were here at that time. But we do have stories and we have history that give us a little bit of insight into what happened at that time. So the Jews were in something of a similar position. It had been many hundreds of years since they had had a direct word from God. They had stories and history to lean on, to tell them who they were. But now they have the appearance of the real king. In their time, in their day, in their place, something new is happening. In the Sermon on the Mount, which we're going to be talking about for a few weeks, Jesus tells us a lot about himself. And every time Jesus tells us something about himself, we need to pay attention. But he also tells us a lot about ourselves, about how we should live in the kingdom of heaven. He jumps right in with the salt and light section. With the salt and light section. Many people consider these few verses, verses 13 through 16, to actually be the concluding section of the Beatitudes, kind of the commentary on the Beatitudes. And if you read it as all of a piece, it makes a lot of sense. Because to very broadly paraphrase the Beatitudes, they talk about how those who seek to please God, in other words, those who are blessed by God, experience the kingdom of heaven now, and yet will receive their full reward in heaven. Throughout the Beatitudes, it's very clear that hardship is part of the journey. But then coming up on the tail end of that, Jesus says, remember, you are salt and light. And note the word are. It is both present tense are, not you will be or you will become, but you are salt and light. And it also means that that is something that comes from inside you. It's not something we put on or acquire. That is our character and our nature, salt and light. I'm not going to go into a ton of detail about salt and light because there are so many applications and so much you can discuss, but I do want to sit in this salt and light for just a few minutes. We, from our perspective, know instinctively that salt and light are essential for life. But the original listeners knew it intimately. Salt was first and foremost a preservative. It was what, for example, made meat safe and edible to eat for more than just a very short period of time. But when we step into our own time, we live in an age where we have too much salt and light. You know, most of us are probably on a low-sodium diet, or we should be if we're not. We consume so much salt, it's hidden in all kinds of food. It dulls our taste buds so that we always need more and more and more, and it raises our blood pressure so that our health declines. So is that what Jesus means about salt losing its saltiness? Well, I don't think that was it. I mean, there are a number of schools of thought about that, and the primary one seems to be that in the ancient world, there were other substances that were either mistaken for salt or mixed with it. And either way, salt did not have its full effect. It didn't serve the same purpose as salt is supposed to serve. Well, we've got the real salt in our diets, in our life, and most of us are looking for substitutes that are safer for us. I'd encourage you to sit in that for a minute and think about what real salt looks like, what real salt accomplishes, and what the quantity needs to be in your life. So what about light? It's hard for us to imagine a world that had no artificial light. But that's what existed then, and it's what still exists in a lot of the world today. But our problem is we can't get away from the light. We have artificial light everywhere we go. In our public spaces, light pollutes our view of the sky. It interferes with the life cycle of a lot of different species. And these little handy devices that we all carry around that give us light wherever we go have essentially put flashlights out of business. We have light everywhere. But you know what light does? It distracts our minds and it diminishes our ability to sleep well. So now we have instructions that tell us we should put these things away, put screens away, at least 30 minutes before we go to bed so we can sleep. So as we read this through 21st century eyes, we are overloaded with salt and light. And ladies, we have to get rid of that mindset. We also instinctively know that Jesus wasn't talking about physical salt and light. He was talking about spiritual salt and light. He was essentially telling the people of Israel, you are the people who preserve and give flavor to God's world. You are the people who shine light into dark places. Go out and be who you are, Israel. Go out and be who you are, Covenant. Go out and be who you are, Dory. Go out and be who you are, Vicky. That's the word to us. Go out and be who you are today, who you are made to be. What the listeners wouldn't have known, but what, of course, Matthew knew, is that Jesus is the ultimate example here because he does preserve God's kingdom, and his light shines from that cross on the top of the hill in that moment and down through the centuries, light that has never gone away. Those rays continue to radiate. So moving from salt and light to something that I know everybody was excited to hear about, law and prophecy. Raise your hand if this was your favorite section of the study. I see no hands. How can that be? You may have heard of the saying, the king is dead, long live the king. So the implication there is that the new king is going to decide how things are done. So that can either be a cause for celebration or a cause for anxiety, depending on where you come from. And in this case, it was probably some of both. There was a lot of excitement about what Jesus was bringing, but also tension about how it related to the law and the prophets, which we can simply read as the Old Testament. This is the body of knowledge and practice that was part of Jesus' very identity. So how is this new king going to respond to all of this history of knowledge and practice? So Jesus immediately affirms his complete support for the Old Testament, but there's a twist. And the twist is that what we now have to follow is Jesus himself, not the list of laws and practices, not the layers of laws and practices, but the actual person of Jesus. Around here at Covenant, Thomas Daniel makes a big point of talking to us about one of the unique features of Christianity is that we follow a person, not dogma. We are not guided by the rules. We are guided by the words and the actions of Jesus. So the words and the actions of Jesus here affirm the law and challenge us to be more righteous. We're not even to break the least commandment. Did you feel good when you read that? Yeah. I didn't feel good either, but we have to look at what Jesus has and what he's really saying here. We have a knee-jerk reaction to the word law, and we know that we are incapable of keeping a lot of times even the big commandments. Forget the little commandments. But where we need to focus our attention is the fact that God's law is good. It is there to help us know and follow God's will for us. The law also brings us face to face with our sinfulness and focuses on the fact that we need a Savior. God's law was never intended as an end unto itself, as in following the law is the whole point. God's law was intended to draw us close to him and also point out the fact that without him, we were utterly incapable. So when we look into the abyss, to use the phrase that Jan used last week, the first thing we see is that we can't do it by ourselves. And we have to sit in that for a while. We can't do it by ourselves. But when we sit in that, we are open to transformation. Transformation from the inside out. And that's the kingdom that Jesus is inaugurating. A kingdom where we are transformed from the heart, and that turns into our action and our lives. So rather than God's law coming from the outside and sinking in, God's law comes from the outside and moves outward. Jesus, a little spoiler alert here, he's going to eventually replace the whole long law with something that's much shorter, not easier, but much shorter. But the only way we can follow that true law is when we have a transformed heart and a contrite spirit. So when you think about the law and prophets, understand that what Jesus is telling us is affirming what we already know. We can't do it by ourselves. We can only do it through Him. And we can only do it when the change comes from the inside and then begins to show in the world. The final section here is the first of several where Jesus is giving us examples of the importance of the law, but also the inadequacy of the law. He uses a style of instruction that's called antithesis, where he says, "You have heard it said, but I say." So in this case, you have heard it said, "Don't murder, but I say." And then he goes on to list these sort of common-sounding things that also qualify as murder and that also would condemn you. So it's pretty easy to say, "I didn't murder anybody today. I can check that one off." You may have had days when you felt like that was your big accomplishment. "Well, I didn't murder anybody today." Check that one off. But when he expounds on the law, he tells us that murder is just one act. It's the result of a lot of acts that went before it. And what he shows us in this section is a series of very extreme-sounding circumstances. We see the man who comes to the temple with his sacrifice, realizes that he's having a dispute with his neighbor, and he's supposed to go home and resolve that dispute. And what the listeners would have understood is that that means leaving the temple in Jerusalem, walking back to wherever you came from, which could be a walk of many days, resolving that dispute and coming back to the temple. So we're not talking about something that's simple. We're talking about something that's very difficult. We see somebody going into court and at the point of judgment, making peace. There's a good reason that Jesus is using these extreme examples. And one of the reasons is that the Jews lived, see if this sounds familiar, in an insult society. Romans insulted the Jews. Samaritans insulted the Jews. Jews insulted one another. People take that home, and family discourse becomes very unsettled. It is toxic to family relationships, to social relationships, and to civic culture at large. The natural result of that kind of discourse and that kind of constant berating of your fellow person is violence. Violence where human life and human well-being is undervalued. And the long-term consequence of that is large-scale conflict and hard-heartedness. So we're not supposed to murder, but really we're not supposed to reach the point where that seems like an option. We're supposed to trace back to the daily decisions that we make. The idea here can really be boiled down to just a couple of words. God's law in this instance is not merely do not murder. It is be reconciled, make friends. So that's the law that Jesus is telling us. The law that comes from inside out. Be reconciled. Make friends. Because when you are reconciled and when you have friends, murder isn't really much of a possibility. Litigation is not what happens when you are reconciled and when you have friends. That's the transformation that Jesus is talking about. That's a transformation that does not come from checking off lists or obeying the law, but from approaching our lives and our relationships in a different manner. I got to experience a little bit of this recently. I'm a mentor in the confirmation program here, and in fact, the student that I'm working with is Vicki Kessler's granddaughter, and a real pleasure for me to be paired up with Anna. So that has been a very fun experience. A couple of weeks ago, we had a full-day Saturday retreat with our confirmation students. And let me tell you, they were excited to show up here at 9 o'clock on a Saturday morning. and have 6 hours with their adult mentors. It was a pretty jazzed bunch of kids. But they came. And the first thing we did that morning was to go to an escape room. Has anyone here experienced an escape room? I had never done it before, so I've heard my young adult children talk about it, but I was neutral, to say about doing it. It was not something I probably would have done otherwise. So the idea of an escape room is that you're in a group, and you are in a sealed-up room, and you have a challenge that you have to work out together. Sometimes there's a theme, like you have to solve a jewel robbery or a murder mystery or something like that. But the idea is that everyone has to contribute to getting you through the escape room. And the reward is that you get out in the amount of time that you're given. Usually it's an hour-long escape room, and you have to try to solve the problem within an hour. So the room that I personally participated in, we had three groups of eight people, four students and four adults. There were three connected rooms. You could see into the other room, but you couldn't walk from room to room. You could talk to the other people, and you could hand them things. The three rooms each had a series of three challenges that they had to solve, and that all led to solving the big challenge, but you couldn't move from one challenge to the next until all three rooms had solved their challenge. And as you would solve your challenge and get clues, you didn't know right away whether whether that clue was for you or whether it was for another room. So lots of confusion. There were 24 people in these three rooms, and I might have mentioned it was Saturday morning, not the prime time for the students. To me, this was a picture of God's kingdom. We needed one another. We didn't necessarily know how we were going to solve these different challenges. We all had different skills and gifts, and there were some of those puzzles. I'd still be there today trying to solve them. I thought were very obvious, and others people didn't think so. Others I would never have figured out by myself. We had to be reconciled and make friends, not only with the people in our room, but with the people in the blue room and the yellow room as well. We were the red room, because it took us all, not knowing what everybody else was confronting, working together to meet the challenge. We got out with 4.5 minutes to spare. I am so proud, because the year before, they had not solved the challenge. So, yay for us. That was a good thing. But it was no one person. There was no single individual who was able to do that. It was a group effort. That's the law here. Be reconciled, make friends. As we go through these next sections, Jesus is going to raise some very hard truths about the law. The law is more and more difficult than we even think it to be. The law, though it's there to point out God's will for our lives, is also there to point us to the fact that we cannot do it on our own, that we can only do it with a transformed heart and a contrite spirit. And that's where we follow Jesus. That's where he is showing us through his words and through his actions what God's kingdom really looks like. So instead of me saying a closing prayer for us, we are going to sing our closing prayer. So, Jean, if you would. So would everyone stand, please. Thank you.